The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
How we're going to go at this is going to be through local forces. And frankly, the military will be the first one to tell you, this is not going to get done by military force alone, which is why we've got a strategy that talks about going after their finances, that goes after their foreign fighters, that goes after the incredible humanitarian issues.
Whether it's Chinese or whoever it is, if we had the opportunity to do the same thing, we'd probably do it. So
you mean they're better than we are?
Well, in this one case, maybe you have to give them a point.
Many of the cases you've mentioned involve people who either are trying to carry out acts of violence or they're trying to travel overseas to Syria, for example, to join ISIS or still to join Al-Qaeda or Al-Shabaab. And we look to see what their networks might be. We look to see who else might be involved in their plan to see, is this the only plan that's out there? So there's a number of things that we look to. In terms of how you handle the prosecution of individuals, every defendant is different, quite frankly.
I'm Cody Poplin, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, August 1st, 2015. That first voice you heard was Lisa Monaco, Homeland Security Advisor to President Barack Obama. The second was Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, and rounding out the band was Attorney General Loretta Lynch. The three spoke at last week's Aspen Security Forum, which has once again allowed us to edit their addresses for the podcast. Monaco is joined by moderator Mike Isikoff of Yahoo News, while both Clapper and Lynch are interviewed by Andrea Mitchell of MSNBC. It's a trio of interviews covering everything from encryption to ISIS and cyber to Russia. All right here on the Lawfare Podcast, episode number 134, Monaco, Clapper, and Lynch, the Aspen Security Summit Mixtape, Volume 2.
On that note, given that the title of this talk, or the subtitle, is you are going to tell us about what keeps you up at night. Tell us about your last few sleepless nights.
thank you for that caveat there. How long do you have? I think we've got a limited time. So people talk about sleepless nights, and the image is invoked of people tossing and turning. So the assumption is that you've actually made it to bed and gotten into the beginning stages of REM sleep. So I can challenge that assumption. So really, it's the question is, do you actually make it into the sleep state? And you usually don't, because the phone calls keep coming. The sleeplessness started very early on in my tenure. As you mentioned, I started in 2013. About 3 weeks into the job, we had the Boston Marathon bombings that affected, obviously, Boston and my hometown. And well into that week, I remember vividly, it was Thursday night. The manhunt was still ongoing for the Boston Marathon bombers. And I got home to my house about 1 a.m. And shortly thereafter, I got a call from the Situation Room telling me about a carjacking that had occurred in Cambridge and the death of a MIT policeman, which we all, of course, know the story now. And it had all the hallmarks of something that I was going to need to be concerned about based on everything we'd been seeing the previous week. So flurry of phone calls, including with the then FBI Director Bob Mueller, his deputy, a number of other folks. And I was back on my way into the office at 3 a.m. And 3 weeks into my job, waking up the president from a sound sleep, so he also had a sleepless night, at 4 a.m. to tell him that one of the bombers was dead and the other one was on the run.
There's been a lot of talk at the conference here about the successes that U.S. policy has had in degrading al-Qaeda. Core al-Qaeda has been described as nearly finished at this point. But clearly, ISIL, the threat from ISIL, is very much with us nearly 10 months after the president announced the military campaign. They're still holding large swaths of territory in Iraq and Syria, including Mosul, Iraq's second largest city. There's this unbelievable propaganda offensive on social media that's drawing people to them. Why has progress against ISIL been so slow?
So I think there's several dimensions of that to take on, right? So ISIL and its efforts in Iraq and Syria, and then, of course, the thing that we've been focusing on here, I think quite rightly, and we should talk more about it today, which is the unique threat that they pose to the homeland now. With regard to your specific question, look, I think there's a number of factors here. And the president has spoken to this most recently a couple weeks ago at the Pentagon. They posed a unique threat in Iraq and Syria, which is why we began the military campaign 10 months ago, because they could demonstrate an ability to take and hold territory. That was a new feature and something we knew we had to go after. Now, they are now embedded in communities. And that poses a difficulty in going after them from the air. But that's not going to be the sum total, and it continues to not be the sum total of what we're doing, and it won't be the way we ultimately route them. The way we're going to route them, and we have had significant success. They've lost a quarter of the territory that they previously had. We've taken a number of between 5,000 and 6,000 strikes between Iraq and Syria with an unprecedented coalition, including a really incredibly galvanized, unified Gulf governments. But it's going to take time. And so they're embedding in the Sunni community. They're embedding in the civilian community, makes them hard to root out. And ultimately, how we're going to go at this is going to be through local forces. And frankly, the military will be the first one to tell you, this is not going to get done by military force alone, which is why we've got a strategy that talks about going after their finances, that goes after their foreign fighters, that goes after the incredible humanitarian issues.
Let me ask you a little bit about goals here, because when the president gave his speech September 10th last year, he said our objective was to degrade and ultimately destroy ISIL. Mm-hmm. And British Prime Minister David Cameron just in the last week gave a TV interview in which he used the same similar language. We have to destroy this caliphate, whether it is in Iraq or Syria. But in his press conference, most recent one, about a week and a half ago, the president used some different language. He said, I think my goal when I turn over the keys to the next president is that we are on track to defeat ISIL, that they are much more contained and we're moving in the right direction and we have pushed back ISIL. So just to clarify, what is the administration's goal here? Is it to destroy ISIL or is it to contain and push it back?
So the goal, as the president has said, is to degrade, defeat, and ultimately to destroy ISIL. But we've got to be very clear-eyed about this. It is going to take time, which is also what Prime Minister Cameron and anybody who's a serious person looking at this will tell you. This is going to be, it's been described as a generational struggle. The campaign itself is one that is not a year, it's not 2 years. Likely, that is not the measure to bring to this. It is going to be an issue that is going to take a lot of time. There's going to be progress, there's going to be setbacks. But our goal is to degrade, defeat, and ultimately to destroy. And that means going after what is their claim. Their claim is to build a caliphate, right? Their claim is to establish an Islamic State. And that is rooted on their ability to take and hold ground and to pursue this ideology and to extend it, whether it's through propaganda on social media or through other means. We've got to delegitimize that effort. We've got to attack and basically make clear to people that you shouldn't buy what they're selling. They can't actually continue to hold territory and maintain legitimacy. They can't actually ultimately govern, and we see examples of it all over the place. They're not actually providing services. They're actually killing some of the people that they're trying to recruit. So we've got to attack not only their ability to hold ground, but ultimately the message that they're trying to perpetuate.
The president in that speech last September also said the campaign will be waged through a steady, relentless effort to take out ISIL wherever they exist. Now, since then, ISIL has spread to Libya, to the Sinai, to Afghanistan. Are we at war with ISIL in Libya and those other countries?
So look, ISIL is undertaking an effort to establish an Islamic State, first in the heartland of Syria and Iraq. But as you said, they are trying to expand to at least eight provinces at this point, Libya being the most advanced and concerning in terms of sending actual operatives focused on external attacks, but everywhere from North Africa to the Caucasus. So yes, we are absolutely concerned about their ability to find safe haven, to take root, and to attract fighters and to then extend their reach against our partners, our allies, and ultimately to the homeland. And we are going to make sure that we are taking steps. If there's a threat posed to the United States from Libya, from one of these places, there should be no satisfaction amongst ISIL that they're going to have a safe haven and that that threat won't be addressed.
So just to be clear, because I know you asked for a new authorization to use mm-hmm. military force against ISIL. You didn't get it, so you're still relying on the old yep. 2001. But the president, in the White House's view, has the authority now to order military strikes in Libya, in the Sinai, in any place in Africa or elsewhere where ISIL rears its head?
Look, the president has the authority to conduct the military operations that we're doing, rooted in the 2001 AOMF. What we have said, however, is we ought to provide the people who are conducting and putting their lives on the line, and we ought to show our partners and the American people that we are unified as a government amongst branches in supporting the efforts of the people waging this fight. That's why we asked for another AUMF, which does not have a geographic boundary, mm-hmm. as you noted. So, in fact, we can address threats that come if ISIL establishes more than a foothold and actually an operational capability.
You have spent a lot of time on the social media component of this, how ISIL is using social media. You had a countering violent extremism summit a couple months ago at the White House, where it was noted that Twitter, which has been the prime vehicle for ISIL to spread its propaganda, no Twitter executives appeared or spoke at that summit. Are you getting enough help and cooperation from Twitter and the other social media companies in policing their networks?
So there's a few things I'd say about this. One is the cooperation has been getting better, but it needs to get even better. So, for instance, there's the tactical approach, right? There will be a horrific beheading video on social media on a particular platform, maybe Twitter. And I think what the law enforcement experts would tell you is if you seek out and go to Twitter or some of the other companies to say, help us address this specific issue, that there is a good deal of cooperation. What we are all struggling with and what we need more from the companies, more help with, is a systematic way to go about addressing what I feel has become an exponential threat posed to the homeland by ISIL and its use of social media. So what do I mean by that?
Yes.
So we've had a lot of discussion here about ISIL's prolific use of social media. When you think about the sheer math involved, right? You've heard the numbers, 2,000 fanboys that ISIL may have, hashtag jihadis that are actually really pushing out some of the most egregious content. If they have, and by some number they do, 50,000 followers each, just simply do the math there. That is an exponential threat of potential vulnerability and radicalization to vulnerable and troubled minds that can pose a real threat to us in the homeland. So we need social media companies to help us address that.
What do you want them to do? Do you want Twitter to take these people down more aggressively?
We want them to take these accounts down more aggressively. But let's be clear.
And when you say that to them, what do they tell you?
So I think there's an ethos that is out there that there needs to be. This is in part a free space. And I think there's a valid discussion to have. I think there is a brutal irony in the fact that a group that gets its entire inspiration in the rejection of modernity, which is ISIL's ethos, is using a platform that has been allowed us in a wonderful way to express, to have free expression and express ideas. But we've got to have a discussion about how we use that platform also to counter that narrative. Because we are not going to delete our way out of this. We're not going to kill our way out of this. We need to have, and in my discussions with tech industry executives, we need to do what's called adding more inventory, right? So I convened a group of tech executives, social entrepreneurs, NGOs, philanthropists, who are all really concerned about this. And I got together with them in Silicon Valley because by no means does the U.S. government have a corner on the wisdom here, a corner on the market of wisdom on this. And we are not the best messengers. Any message to counter ISIL's narrative that comes with a U.S. government seal is by definition not going to be something that is appealing to the target audience here. So what can we do uniquely as a government? We can use our convening power. We can bring together tech executives, NGOs, alternative voices, and put them together to try and solve this problem. So when I raised this with some of the folks I met with out at Stanford, at a wonderful place called the Design School, the D School, which does some tremendous innovative thinking, they said, we would love to suppress those search results like they do for child pornography and use algorithms to, when somebody is seeking out a beheading video, they don't get that. That comes back at, you know, view page 30 instead of number one. But we don't have any inventory to replace it with. And that is a really bracing concept. So we need to have put those smart technology minds and distribution platforms together with alternative voices, legitimate voices who can counter this narrative and create that laboratory and spread that message out.
We've had a lot of talk about policy here, but you've had some personal gut-wrenching experiences as the government's point person in dealing with the families of the hostages that were being held by ISIL and others. I wonder if you could just sort of take us into the room, into the White House, or wherever you were, nearly a year ago when the James Foley beheading video was released by ISIL, and tell us a little bit about what it was like to watch that, what your thoughts and reaction was, and how you told the president about it.
This issue is one that I think has been one of the hardest emotionally, policy-wise, and humanity issues to deal with sitting in my seat, and for all of us in the intelligence and law enforcement communities and in the counterterrorism community. On that day, and I remember it vividly, I was sitting in my office in the ground floor of the West Wing, the same one that Fran just referenced, and I was actually on the phone with Ben Rhodes, who was traveling with the president at the time. He was on his way up to Martha's Vineyard, and one of my staff came in to say that this video had appeared. We didn't have advance warning of it, and I watched the pretty lengthy video and recounted it and described it quite horrifically to Ben Rhodes, who was traveling with the president at the time. And how did I feel? I was sick to my stomach. It was a horrific thing to see. And having spent time with Diane Foley and John Foley and John Foley Jr. It was gut-wrenching is the right word for it, and it was horrible. And the videos that came after it were equally so. And it galvanized us even more to try and take a hard look at what we need to do better by these families, and that's what we did.
Did you call the Foleys?
I did not call the Foleys. After that, the president did. I had spoken to them before, several times before that video came out. I had spoken to them a few days after the president did, but I was not the one who informed them of the video.
How much of an impact did that video and then the subsequent one a week or two later, or a few weeks later, of the beheading of Steve Sotloff, and the knowledge that you had another hostage, Kayla Mueller, still being held by ISIL, how much of an impact did that have on the decision to launch the military campaign against ISIL in September?
So it is something that was not out of our minds, certainly. But we also, you know, you had demands in these videos for America to, and for the president in particular, in the United States, to undertake or to not undertake certain operations, and we could not have our foreign policy decisions impacted by a murderous band of brutal, brutal thugs. And that is a hard thing to understand. It's a hard thing to say. But I will tell you, I also spoke to a number of parents who at the time had their children still in harm's way. And a few of them were quite clear with me that they didn't want it to change our calculus. And just a point on this, Mike, I have to say, I've spent a lot of time with the parents of the Americans who were killed and those who still have their loved ones in harm's way. And to a person, I have been awestruck and inspired by the grace, the courage, the smarts, and the dedication and determination they have to turn some light from the just incredible darkness that ISIL has been perpetrating. And their help in our hostage policy review was invaluable. And the fact that they had the courage to engage with the government, who they feel and who they rightly feel at times let them down, is really a testament to what's great about this country.
Another issue that you have spent a lot of time on is Guantanamo, and I believe you're about to present a plan to Senator McCain to fulfill the president's commitment on his first full day in office to shut Guantanamo down. You've obviously run into a lot of roadblocks, including opposition from Congress. We heard just this morning from Chairman McCaul of the Homeland Security Committee. He does not believe that detainees should be transferred out of there. What's left is the worst of the worst. What can you tell us about your new plan, where you would put the detainees, and why it will succeed any better than your previous plans that have failed?
So my hope is that those who in Congress, including Senator McCain, who's been thoughtful on this and who is a supporter of closing Guantanamo, as is the president, in a responsible way. My hope is that we can work with him and his colleagues to get this done. This is not something that the president wants to turn over to his successor. And the plan, and it's I think maybe it's worth demystifying, is consistent with what the president has said all along. We're going to transfer safely and securely everyone who has unanimously by the president's national security team been deemed eligible for transfer. That's 52 people at current count, subject to security arrangements with the receiving country. So that doesn't mean just unlocking the door and having somebody go willy-nilly to another country. It means a painstaking establishment of security protocols that would govern the transfer of that individual. So we're going to transfer everyone who has been deemed eligible for transfer consistent with security. And we're going to prosecute those who can be prosecuted. But here I will say, this is one of the roadblocks you described. Right now we've got 10 people subject to the military commissions. There are some other number who could be prosecuted in federal court and sent to a supermax prison. Right now, we are barred by statute from bringing anybody here from Guantanamo, even to put them in a supermax prison.
So, but you've also got, what, about 58 who have been deemed too dangerous to release and not enough evidence to bring to trial. Where would you put those detainees in the United States?
So this is something, again, ever since the first term, we've been quite clear. Those who are too dangerous to release, and we've been very clear that there is a number that the national security team has made clear are right now too dangerous to release. That was a unanimous decision of the president's national security team. So right now, let's give some numbers. 116 detainees in Guantanamo today. On January 21st, 2009, that number was 242. In the last administration, before President Obama took office, some 530 detainees were transferred, have already been transferred out of Guantanamo Bay. So we're at 116 right now. 52 of them are deemed eligible for transfer subject to security restrictions. And the balance are in what we call the law of war category. They have been deemed right now too dangerous to release. Now, what the president also did was say that group who either can't be prosecuted or are too dangerous to release, we are going to continue to evaluate their status. And he put in place something called a periodic review board. To date, we have held 13 of those periodic review boards. And 10 instances, those individuals have been transferred to the transfer bucket. So we are going to whittle down this group to what I refer to as the irreducible minimum, who would have to be brought here to a secure location, held under the laws of war, continuing under military detention. And that's the only way we're going to be able to close Guantanamo and then subject those individuals either to prosecution in military commission or Article III courts and a supermax cell. And ultimately, that's the way we're going to do it. But we got to work with Congress. And right now, we aren't even able to put that facility together because of the legal restrictions.
Right. And I think the president has said that he will veto a National Defense Authorization Act if it does not lift the restrictions on transferring detainees to Guantanamo. If he does that, then he will then act unilaterally and bring these detainees out of Guantanamo into the United States?
No, what I'm saying
is, if his veto is sustained.
What I'm saying is we're trying to work with the Congress, and Senator McCain has been very forthright about this. Secretary Carter and I have had discussions with the senator. He said, rightly, give us a plan for how you want to do this. And most importantly, I think his concern and others is, if those individuals are brought to the United States, how can we be sure that they can continue to be held securely and will not be let out on some legal technicality?
But I just want to be clear. If his veto is sustained, he will act unilaterally to bring those detainees into the United States.
We're going to work with Congress to try and get this done. And we've got, I'm going to take Senator McCain at his word that he wants to work with us. Let's look at this, Mike. I mean, why hand over this albatross to the president's successor? And we have made clear that we've got the legal strictures in place that would these detainees, if they're brought to the United States and held in a military facility, they would not be afforded relief under the immigration laws. They would continue to be held. They'd either be prosecuted in a military commission or put in a supermax, which, by the way, the costs involved here, and this, I think, is why Senator McCain and some others believe we really should close Guantanamo. Today, right now, $3 million per detainee per year to house them in Guantanamo.
We could
be spending that money on a host of national security threats that we've been talking about all week.
The basic argument for shutting Guantanamo down from the beginning was that it was a recruitment tool for Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is now almost finished, and ISIL's propaganda recruiting young people has very little, if anything, about Guantanamo. Isn't the whole premise of the argument for shutting down Guantanamo somewhat diminished now?
No, because
it is not the recruitment tool that it was.
I don't think so, because there's a number of arguments for closing Guantanamo. One is that it's used as a propaganda and recruiting tool, and that continues. The other is that it has caused a number of our partners to constrain their cooperation with us because of their concerns about Guantanamo. And the third is the sheer cost. So the number I just gave you, that's today's cost. This is an aging population and an aging facility. That cost is going to go up. In an age of sequestration and the incredible burden being put on our military, cycling guard forces in and out to do what they do, frankly, quite professionally and with dignity, but it is not something that their talents, that they joined the military to do. We need to be putting that money and those talents of those servicemen against other threats.
Director Clapper, I wanted to ask you first about the threat to the homeland from lone wolves and those in particular inspired by social media. How do you assess the threat? How do you defend against it?
Well, thanks, and thanks for having me here. And yes, it was an interesting carrier landing approach. So get your adrenaline up. As to the question, I think Jim Comey, I did watch his interview with Wolf Blitzer, and I think he spoke to this. And the problem for us in intelligence is with the way people radicalize on their own or are radicalized via social media, where they don't leave a signature, they don't emit, if you will, and I mean that in a holistic sense, some attribute or trait or behavior that would lead you to begin watching them. And so we're lacking that. And this phenomenon of the radicalization, either on one's own or through the vehicle of social media, and I think Jim spoke to the challenge we have now where someone is proselyted by an ISIL recruiter sitting in Syria or someplace. And then if there is interest that is evoked on the part of the one being proselyted, the potential extremist, and then they'll switch to, encrypted communications that we can't watch, we can't monitor. And as Jim has said publicly, there are now investigations in every one of the 50 states. And this is a real worry, a real concern for us because I personally think it's a question of time before we have more of these than we've had already. And it's a very daunting challenge for us. And I think it's illustrative of how the threat has morphed to a certain extent from, the industrial size attack of the magnitude of a 9/11. In which there are, or were, as we learned afterwards, signatures that could have forewarned us had we seen them. And in this case, we don't have those, even though there are a smaller scale. But as we've seen with the case in the shootings in Chattanooga, the psychological impact that has is, I think, quite profound. So it's a serious threat.
In the case of Abdulaziz in Chattanooga, was there encryption?
I don't believe so. There's been no connection made with, at least that I am aware of thus far, although this is still under investigation, and there, the Bureau and the police are still researching this. And in fact, that's one thing I think we need to keep some records on this, where we run into an encryption situation and that stymies an investigation. And I think we probably need to see what we can do a better job of keeping some metrics on that.
There's been testimony recently about end-to-end encryption and developing a new relationship with some of the companies involved. There's a lot of tension, though, because of past allegations of abuse and their own corporate interests. How do you resolve that?
That's a great question. And I'm kind of where Jim is on this as well. I am not a technologist. I certainly understand, believe me, both sides of the issue here on solarizing privacy and the impacts on commercial interests versus the need for national security or law enforcement investigations. And it's just hard for me to believe, though, that in this country, the United States of America, the heart of innovation and technical ingenuity, that we somehow can't figure out a solution to this where somehow both interests are attended to. I don't know what that is. That's a dilemma for us.
Is this online threat, the threat of social media, the ISIL or ISIS threat, greater now than core al-Qaeda to the homeland?
Well, that's a hard, actually a hard question, because it's different. It's threatening. To say one is of greater magnitude than the other, at least for me, is hard.
I wanted to ask you about cyber attacks and what we've recently experienced with this massive attack on the government, on OPM. Admiral Rogers suggested that what's different is the scale. This was appreciably larger, 22 million plus people, not just the intelligence community, but their friends, their relatives, anyone who they put down as references. Doesn't the scale of this attack, millions and millions of people, require some kind of different response?
Well, yes, and I think Admiral Rogers has also been very articulate about, and in my view, correct, about the need for some kind of cyber norms, and a part of that would be some form of deterrence, which we don't have right now, either the substance or psychology of deterring cyber incursions. And until such time as we come up with a form of deterrence that works, we're going to have more and more of this. As he also said, and I agree with him, this is not a one-off. We're going to have more and more of this. And, of course, reacting after the fact, which is the way we do things now, and then we mediate and try, we'll do the fixes and all that, as he can attest, and as we, all of us in the IC, can attest, is very, very resource intensive. But this is kind of, in a sense, a new norm.
Yet it's been reported that the administration has decided that economic cyber attacks like Sony, and we quickly heard officials identified North Korea, is one thing and will be responded to, but that this kind of attack will not be, because it's the norm. It's within the parameters of the espionage world, spy agencies against spy agency. Can you explain
that? That's part of the problem, because there has been the tendency or the practice, I think, to acquiesce when it's passive. In other words, if you're just collecting information, which we all do, kind of reminds me of the classic line from Casablanca, what they're spying here, I'm shocked. We all do it. That versus what we're moving into, where there's, and as it was in the case of Sony, genuine damage that can be, physically measured. I know that, there's a lot of talk about loss of intellectual property and the value of that. That turns out to be a hard thing to do, because we did some work on this in the intelligence community, and in fact, in an NIE, National Intelligence Estimate. and just went through the trying to describe the difficulty of quantifying intellectual property on a sort of even playing field basis. That's very hard to do. So there is the issue of nation states conducting espionage, which, you know, we all do, versus damage. And so as we've seen these progression of attacks, denial of service, and what I see, I think the next wave, if you will be data deletions and data manipulation, which will also be very, very damaging. But as this progresses and people will get, push the envelope, whether nation states are hacked or individuals, non-nation state entities, I think we're going to see more and more aggressiveness until such time as we can create both the psychology and the substance of deterrence.
But haven't they crossed the line with this instance in that it's 22 million people and it's people who are complete bystanders? They're not government employees.
Well, what's the line? That's the issue. Have you described the red line there? And there's no question about, and I think Jim Comey spoke to this, but what a gold mine this is for a foreign intelligence service. I'm just speaking generically, by the way. A foreign intelligence service, and particularly the impacts on the intelligence community and its people. I mean, the implications here are huge, and by the way, long-lasting.
You did acknowledge that China was the leading suspect in a public forum. You said you have to kind of salute the Chinese for what they did. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think if... whether the Chinese or whoever it is, if we had the opportunity to do the same thing, we'd probably do it. So
you mean they're better than we are?
Well, in this one case, you could, maybe you have to give them a point. But it is, and of course, it's an obvious lesson here is the need to attend to our defense. But we can't be constantly in the reactive mode. What we've found is that just sort of common sense things oftentimes aren't done. And people need to learn what phishing is and not opening attachments that look funny. You know, just kind of basic common sense hygiene, which is, that really isn't rocket science. But... it was a haul, no question about it.
How do you respond in cases where you want to respond without setting off a cyber war?
Well, that's precisely the issue. The concerns that always come up whenever we have, I've been a party to these endless discussions about what are the second, third order effects or unintended consequences. And that is always an inhibitor. And of course, we're always mindful of the state of our defenses. Somebody wants to counterattack. What are the implications of that? And these get to be very, very complex and very technical and very ethereal discussions about what the implications are if in fact we retaliate.
I want to talk about
in the case of the North Koreans, I might add that what we ended up doing was sanctioning individual Koreans, North Koreans. We really didn't, it was a conscious decision not to reciprocate in kind.
So it was proportional or calculated?
I think it's calculated.
I want to ask you about the Iran deal. What is your level of confidence after the North Korean reactor in Syria that we didn't know about, after AQCOM, after all of the underground facilities we were unaware of until they were constructed, what is your level of confidence now that the North Koreans will not get something, rather that the Iranians will not get something from North Korea, from the Pakistanis, and get components for a weapon without our knowledge?
Well, neither... with this agreement or any other like it, can there be 100% certitude that you know, we will see everything or detect any nefarious activity. I will say, though, that from strictly from an intelligence perspective, that this is a good thing for intelligence because of the pervasive surveillance prerogatives that will be given to the IAEA, assuming the Iranians comply with what is in the written agreement. So we'll have far better insight on the certainly the industrial aspects of the Iranian nuclear program with this deal than what we have today. So the Congress required us to submit a supplementary annex, which we've done, that explains in excruciating detail what our capabilities will or won't be in terms of the intelligence a capability to monitor a compliance with this agreement. Now, is it 100% lock-proof guaranteed? No, we couldn't say that. But it is puts us in a far better place in terms of insight and access than we have today.
What about the accusation that there are side deals? The IAEA negotiates, as we all knew they were, separately with individual countries that are signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Are these secret agreements, or have they been fully briefed in classified
session
to Congress?
Well, there are agreements, which is kind of standard under the safeguard arrangements for the IAEA, the agreements they have on a sort of bilateral basis, that is IAEA to the nation in question. So the IAEA has told our negotiating team, and I know Secretary Ernie Moniz is deeply involved in this, that they are satisfied with the arrangement that has been worked out with the Iranians. We don't know exactly what that arrangement is.
So we're outsourcing it to the IAEA.
Well, that's not a unique process, though, but that's essentially the case. Now, this only has to do with the one aspect of the, you know, the PMD, the previous military dimensions, prior military dimensions, and how that will be addressed between the Iranians and the IAEA.
How important is it that we come to a complete understanding of prior military dimensions, of basically how close they came to getting a
weapon? Well, I'm not sure that even if, you know, they come clean, so to speak, that that's going to add a great deal to what we already understand that they were doing prior to 2003. So it would be an affirmation. I think it would be a confidence-building measure. But in terms of gaining more insight or learning more about what the nature of what they were doing, it won't. I think the approach that the team took was that, yes, this is important, but rather than retrospectively, looking prospectively is more important.
Does the agreement let the Iranians do their own soil testing at Parchin? Because one of the senators at the hearing yesterday said that's the equivalent of letting somebody...
Well, it's fast guard and chicken coop.
Do their own urine test,
again,
or drug test.
This gets into the specifics of the agreement, and I honestly don't know what those are.
You testified that you couldn't be confident that this nuclear agreement would change Iranian behavior in other dimensions prior to the agreement being negotiated.
Right.
What do you think the effect of this agreement will be now that it's been done on Iranian behavior in the region?
Well, the considered IC judgment, which is based on a pretty solid assessment, is that the lion's share of the funding that would be freed up with the sanctions relief will go to things economic. That's the reason they came to the table. And it is our belief that that's where the bulk of the money will go, because they have many, many demands in Iran for fixing the economy. Now, the funding proxies, funding the IRGC, the Quds Force, and all that, well, they've been funded anyway, even with the sanctions regime. So I'm sure they'll get some money. But I don't think it'll be a huge windfall for them because, as I say, they've already been funded. So we believe, our assessment is that the lion's share of whatever funding is freed up will go to the economy.
They've already been punching above their weight, given what they spend, what the Quds Force, the IRGC, spends compared to what some of the Gulf states spend. And they've been achieving a lot in the region. So even a fraction of what they will get from sanctions relief would be a considerable benefit to the military.
Well, it would be some benefit. I don't know, again, get any of the adjectives of some considerable. They've got some of the same challenge, though, that pouring money into what has become black holes for them as well. They've got some challenges there as to how that funding would be used and the impact it would have. And so, looking at it from their standpoint, if you look at what's going on in Syria or Yemen, well, they've got tall mountains to climb there too.
I wanted to ask you about Russia. General Dunford testified recently that, quote, if you want to talk about a nation that could pose an existential threat to the United States, it would be Russia. What is your assessment long-term of the threat from Vladimir Putin's Russia?
Well, first, I think because there's a lot of controversy about characterizing threats or picking out, what's most threatening. And I think it's useful to keep in mind, at least in the intelligence context, that there are two dimensions to gauging a threat. One is capability, and the other is intent. And that applies whether it's a nation state or a non-nation state. So if you look at capability, clearly the entity, and in this case it's a nation state, and it's Russia, which could wreak the most damage on this country is clearly Russia, which has a very capable strategic nuclear arsenal, which they are modernizing. And very committed to modernizing their nuclear capability. So I'm in agreement with General Dunford on the capability and Russia as an existential threat. That's not to say they have necessarily the intent to unleash that nuclear strategic arsenal. So I have to keep those, to me at least, those two dimensions in mind.
As you look at Russian behavior in Ukraine, for instance, how do you assess, what is your estimate of what their intention is?
Well, clearly, they, by whatever means, they want to keep Ukraine in their orb. I think Putin is somewhat of a throwback to the Tsar eras in terms of his vision of a great Russia. And, of course, his characterization of the breakup of the Soviet Union as the greatest geopolitical disaster in history or something, whatever he said. And so Ukraine or Little Russia is, I think, such a ingrained part of the psyche of Russia that they have got to figure out some way where they can keep Ukraine under their thumb. And, of course, what they're most concerned about is move to the West, joining the EU, and of course, complete anathema to them would be joining NATO. So however this works out with keeping some, frozen conflict, and I don't think the conflict is frozen yet, they're going to maintain their influence over Ukraine, to federalize it, to prevent Ukraine from orienting towards the West.
Let me ask you about a safer topic then, chemical weapons in Syria.
Let's go from one to another.
The Wall Street Journal has reported that the intelligence agencies, the West, missed some of the stockpiles when they investigated. Is that accurate?
No, it's not. From the get-go, we had our assessments of the chemical weapons holdings in Syria. We, the intelligence community, and we used those to gauge the Syrian declarations and then what was ultimately moved. Those were never, ever congruent. We have never said from the beginning that, A, we had a 100% accurate assessment, because, we don't get to walk around their warehouses and count that but we, you know, it was pretty good. And we believe that there were probably 95% or so were removed. But that has been our assessment from the beginning.
I want to ask you a related question about the war against ISIS in Syria and why it has taken so long, and after a year and so much money spent, we have such a small number of trained forces. It's something like a 4% success rate. Why is it so difficult to train fighters to go up against?
Well, it's not so much training them, it's vetting them. And, of course, the criterion here you have to remember is those fighters who are willing to go after ISIS. If you want to sign them up to go after Assad, no problem. But if it's only ISIS, which is what our policy has been, so the combination of finding people who are genuinely committed to doing that and, B, who can pass the pretty extensive vetting that the Department of Defense system that the Department of Defense has set up. And so that has been the difficulty that has been posed to us so far.
And on the Iraqi side of the border, such as the border is, you still have an Iraqi army that turns and runs from Fallujah, turns and runs from Ramadi, from Mosul. What, aside from using General Soleimani and Shiite militias, what is the...
Yeah, well, they're pretty good.
And so is that the
solution?
Well,
that is a serious problem with... And more and more, the Iraqi government itself has become dependent on the PMC, which is the collection of militia forces, which unfortunately have been consistently more effective than the Iraqi security forces. And I think, you know, there's been discussion about this, and it kind of boils down to will to fight, which is a very hard thing to gauge ahead of time. It's not a function of equipment or training, because we've certainly done that over a period of years, generously with the Iraqi security forces. But they have not had that, and there's all kinds of other functional reasons for that. And what's happened is Prime Minister Abadi, who I think means well, understands what needs to be done, but has had great difficulty with bringing in the Sunnis as a effective part of his fighting force, and increasingly relying on the militias, which have been effective.
There's a lot of talk about the president's plan to close the Guantanamo prison. Is it realistic to think that that can be done?
Well, it's hard, but not hopeless, I guess, to borrow a phrase here. Yeah, the president committed to this, I think, his second day in office, that closing Guantanamo. And we have slowly reduced the population there down to 116, and getting down to the hardcore cases where, you know, other countries have taken on detainees that have been repatriated. I think, though, we're going to get down to a core set of 60 or so in that neighborhood that we can't repatriate, and will have to be moved. Now, obviously, the Congress gets a big vote here, and they've already established a pretty high bar for certifying our assessment, particularly the Secretary of Defense has to certify this on when we repatriate a detainee. I will say that, and of course the concern is the return to the battlefield, and the overall recidivist rate is running just about 30%, but since 2009, using the vetting process, the vetting system we've used, the recidivist rate is just under 6%. So I think doing this has worked, but I think getting down to this last group is going to be tough. Now, Senator McCain, who's been, I think, helpful here in trying to negotiate a plan, and is awaiting one from the administration, which is being worked on.
I was asking questions of the Cuban foreign minister at the State Department on Monday, which was quite an experience, a first. And he is insistent that Cuba should get Guantanamo Bay back, the naval base, not the prison. And having looked it up, we leased it in 1901 under the Platt Act for $14,000 a year, checks that Cuba has never cashed because they don't want to acknowledge our role there as lessors. How strategically important is that naval base for us?
Well, happily, that's not an intelligence issue.
No intelligence takes place there.
No, I mean, it's not an issue where intelligence has got a big equity. So,
Director Clapper, thank you for being here. My name is Jacob Marks. I'm a researcher at the Project on Government Oversight and one of the Aston Scholars. What do you think is the value of intelligence community whistleblowers, and what are your thoughts on extending whistleblower protections to intelligence community contractors? Thank you.
Well, I think, first of all, there needs to be a mechanism where a legitimate whistleblower can express himself or herself. And so we have worked to create that environment and that system. And of course, the challenge we have in the intelligence community is people want to whistleblow. Would rather they didn't whistleblow with classified information that they expose on their own. And so there has to be a mechanism built that accommodates that. And so ours is overseen by the ICIG in the interest of autonomy and independence, certainly from me or, you know, command influence, as you call it in the military. And that will be, and that's going to apply to contractors as well.
Can I just ask a follow-up about Edward Snowden and whether there would be a way, do you think, for him to come back? Are there negotiations underway?
I don't know about that. That's a Department of Justice thing. Sure, I'm happy to come back and stand trial.
Yes. Chris Isham.
By the way, if I may, just let me add to that, not to be flip about it. I could certainly understand Edward Snowden's concerns about what he considered, jeopardy of civil liberties and privacy. And had that been all that had been exposed, I'd have probably been okay with it, or at least accepted it. But he exposed so many other things and did so much other damage that had nothing to do with surveillance or civil liberties and privacy of citizens in this country. And that's my hang up with him.
Let me start out by asking you, what do you see as the greatest threat to the homeland from terrorism?
Well, thank you, Andrea. And first of all, let me thank both Walter and my old friend Clark for this kind invitation. It is truly, truly an honor to be here with this group. I've seen your agenda. I know that I'm following some extremely heavy hitters, some of whom are still here in the front row. So I'm truly happy to be here, and I thank you for that warm welcome. With regards to the most serious threat to the homeland from terror, I think we certainly have seen the emergence of different terrorist groups. I think the greatest threat overall, frankly, is the fact that the terror threat is morphing. It is fracturing. It is expanding beyond the old school Al-Qaeda and its offshoots, which are still viable organizations. They're still dangerous organizations. We have made great inroads against Al-Qaeda and its affiliates. We have done well in the fight against Al-Qaeda, frankly, due to a great deal of international cooperation and the dedicated work of our military, as well as our intelligence, our law enforcement, and our courts, quite frankly. We've prosecuted a large number of them. But what we see is the terror threat shifting and morphing. For example, it used to be that an Al-Qaeda splinter would stay in the Arabian Peninsula or in the Maghreb.
You would still know how they operated. And now we see the emergence of one of the most recent al-Qaeda splinters of ISIL, which has grown to a degree and significantly changed the terror landscape and sort of opened it up for the independent contractors of terrorism, almost, individuals who need not have a prior affiliation with ISIL, but who can carry out acts of violence, acts of terror, both Europe, Asia, and here, unfortunately, then claim attribution. And if ISIL thinks that, in fact, it's an act that advances their goals, they will adopt it also. So I would say that we certainly still see the backdrop of the groups we've been fighting for so long, the emergence of new groups, and we don't know what's on the horizon, quite frankly. So I think that the best way to characterize it is the terror threat is still consistently from foreign terrorist organizations, although we do have, sadly, domestic terrorists as well. And the splinting and morphing of that is a great concern to all of us who fight this issue.
How well equipped are we to fight the attraction of the social media exhortations to lone wolves, to disenfranchised youth here in the United States?
You know, that's an excellent question. I think it goes really to a number of issues that a lot of us have been looking at for a long time, not just fighting the attraction of groups like ISIL, but the attraction of groups still like al-Qaeda or al-Shabaab. We have situations where young people in this country who feel rootless, who feel disconnected, will connect with a violent strand of an extremist thought. And it may be ISIL, it may be al-Shabaab, it may still be al-Qaeda, and it draws them in. I think that we spend a lot of time thinking about how to counter that. We spend a lot of time thinking about how to strengthen communities, how to empower families to recognize the signs that their young person might be drifting that way. We spend a lot of time trying to empower communities to build other options for young people. And it's a challenge because you have a lot of communities that, because unfortunately there's often a backlash against many of our ethnic communities when we do terror cases or when events occur, they don't always trust the government to be the ones to help them. They don't always trust us to be the ones to provide that bridge. And in fact, we're not the only ones who can provide that bridge. We're working not only the Department of Justice, but education, you know, reaching out to schools to try and connect with young people. One of the things that we spend a lot of time doing is talking to community groups, talking to leaders of not only Muslim groups, but also leaders of communities and schools, and saying to them, when you see someone begin to change in a way that gives you pause, try everything you can to pull that person back in. If you look at a lot of these cases that have happened most recently, people will, in hindsight, look back and say, you know, I saw something, I heard something. This person was talking about taking an action that I would never have thought that they would take, an extreme violence. But I didn't take it seriously, or I didn't want to impose on their privacy. But in particular, it's for parents. I've gone to Muslim community groups in my former district on Long Island and had a lot of very candid conversations with people about this issue. And at first, the discussion usually starts off with a concern that we might be targeting their young people, that we might be somehow entrapping them or through government action drawing them into this. And we talk about that, and I will usually outline the cases, and you can see how people have been drawn in from the internet, from social media. And then I'll ask all the parents in the room, do you know what your child did online just last night? And the reality is very few of us know what our kids are doing online. And so we see this threat emerging, and really it's a very dangerous one.
How much of a challenge is the fact that they go dark? I mean, encryption now is a real problem for anyone trying to track these online communications. Once they're drawn in, they quickly go dark.
Certainly a challenge. Certainly a challenge for us And certainly, I'm sure you've had a lot of discussion about that this week. Looking at your agenda items, this issue would have come up. It's a matter of grave concern for all of us in law enforcement and all of us in the intelligence community or the military who are working on this issue, because we are really only as good as our ability to track these individuals and to determine their plans before they can execute them. I will say this, the aim of the Department of Justice and all of our partners in this is still the prevention of the next terror attack. That is our goal. That has been our mandate since 9/11. And we have done a great deal of work and have had a great deal of success in doing that. But when we have a situation where we start out seeing someone in communications with those that we know are looking for affiliates and associates to carry out actions, and they switch to a platform that we can no longer, through our usual court process, gain access to, it's very challenging, and frankly, it's very troubling. And I know that sometimes the debate goes into how we are interacting with the companies. We really are interacting with them very well. We are having a lot of very, very substantive discussions about ways in which we can work together to work on this issue, and we don't have a fix yet. You know, quite frankly, we don't. But I think that we certainly can find one. And I think that the important thing is that we all share the same goal of stopping terrorist activity. But it is a challenge. It's a challenge for the government. And I think it's, frankly, a challenge for the companies that do work so well with us and have in the past to find a way to continue that relationship also.
Is it a much greater challenge post-Snowden in that the companies have their own commercial interests and the whole issue of privacy is so toxic now with their publics?
Well, certainly I think that the Snowden disclosures raised the issue and highlighted it for a number of people. Privacy has always been an important issue, and it's always been something that I think every tech company has known the significance of safeguarding, and they've always taken steps to do that. Certainly the commercial model now has come to rely heavily on the appeal of that encryption, or the appeal of the fact that no one can see what you're saying and the government can't get into what you're doing. And the reality is, you know, I don't want to get into what people are doing. I don't want to see what you're saying unless you're talking about blowing up a building, or unless you've kidnapped a child, or unless you're talking about targeting someone who, for example, hosted a Draw Muhammad contest and is now in danger because of that. That's my only interest in going into what people are doing and saying. And so I think that it's an important goal to have secure communications. I carry 4 phones, so believe me, I'm very focused on electronic security. But I think that, again, we are working well with the companies. What I will say is, as someone who is a consumer, and frankly does appreciate the work that they're doing, at the end of the day, however, the contract that the companies have with consumers, and that includes me, it's a commercial contract. The contract that I have to protect the American people is the Constitution. And that's my obligation, and that's what I work under.
In this new environment, we spent so much time after 9/11, you as a successful prosecutor in Brooklyn, prosecuting so many of these terror cases, thinking about mass attacks, about another 9/11, and now what we're seeing are movie theaters and mass shootings, a rash in just the last 3 weeks, not all related to foreign terror, some domestic terror. Do we have to change the way we live? Do there have to be magnetometers at strip malls and movie theaters? What are the implications for the American society in what's been happening lately?
Well, I think the implications are that we all have to think about the type of security that we want. And whatever changes that we make, we have to make them fully informed of their consequences. We are seeing a shift, certainly in the area of domestic terrorism. As we've talked about, ISIL in particular is looking for people who are in various countries, including our own, to carry out solo acts or small group acts, and then take credit for them. We have people who are engaged in domestic terrorism, and frankly, we have disturbed individuals who also will wreak havoc, considerable havoc there. A lot of other countries have dealt with this over the years in terms of their civilian population being what are called soft targets of terrorism. And frankly, it's part of the changing face of the threat that we're seeing also. And I think we have to be careful. We have to be cognizant of the risks and cognizant of the threats. But my view is that we cannot let terrorism prevent us from living our lives. We cannot let terrorism prevent us from enjoying the free and open society that's so important to us, because that's the real goal. That's the real aim of the terrorist actor. It is to change us internally and to convert us from a nation that's open and outward-looking into a nation that is frightened and inward-looking and stops innovating and stops building. So I say we do not stop doing our activities, in particular going out and enjoying the fruits of this great country. This has come up in particular with, obviously, the recent shooting in a church. In no way should that prevent people from going to houses of worship.
I wanted to ask you about cyber attacks. You've been a prosecutor of cyber crime as well, but cyber attacks, and in particular the OPM attack, is on a scale, really an unprecedented scale, in terms of an attack on our government. John McCain today described the OPM hack as the equivalent of an act of war and said the administration has no plan to deter or retaliate. Does the administration need a plan when something happens on a scale this large?
Well, I think it certainly raises a host of implications, and certainly there are plans for dealing with the breach itself. I sit here as one of the government employees who did receive that letter that said, all your data is now somewhere overseas. And so there certainly are plans for dealing with it in terms of the personal cost and the personal issues that it raises. With respect to cybersecurity itself, there certainly are plans for reviewing how this type of hack occurred, as well as several others that have occurred over the past recent years, and how we can strengthen ourselves. With respect to dealing with the perpetrator of that, that's something that's going to be under consideration by a lot of people for several days and weeks and months to come. So I'm not privy to all of those, so I'm not able to go into that. But I certainly think it's something that is part of the national discussion. Frankly, you asked earlier about national security and terrorism, and certainly that's one of my top priorities as Attorney General. And one of my next priorities is cybersecurity, improving our cybersecurity and improving the way in which we can hopefully prevent these attacks and, if not, mitigate the damage from them.
Well, yesterday, Director Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence, told us here that this has been a gold mine for a foreign intelligence service, and he said the implications are huge and long-lasting. And now there are reports today that the identities of undercover operatives in China have been compromised, potentially, that it will be easy to piece together their identities, so their service overseas is probably at an end. This is an enormous cost to our intelligence services, to say nothing of the personal cost.
Yes.
To friends, relatives, and others mentioned in their background checks.
Yes, it is a huge cost to our intelligence service, to our operations, our ability to work with our partners overseas through operatives, as well as a huge cost to the people who were personally affected by it. I'm not sure how knowing my college address freshman year is really going to help anyone in terms of espionage, but there might be some other things there that could.
Do you think that some of our undercover operatives have been compromised permanently?
Well, I can't speak to that in terms of specifics. I think that when we look at the trend in recent years of hacks and disclosures of data that do contain sensitive information, that do touch on information that may reveal the identities of people who are working in an undercover capacity, it is a matter of great concern.
If the identities in their personnel records were so easily ascertained, how safe is our financial system, our aviation system, nuclear power plants, the rest of our infrastructure?
Well, you've certainly hit upon the issue that troubles every prosecutor who works in this area, and frankly, all of us in government who work in this area. And we are spending a great deal of time having discussions with every sector that you mentioned about strengthening cybersecurity. One of the things that we're doing is forging partnerships with private industry, the financial industry, other industries, for example, to work with them so that when they discover cover an infiltration, we can work with them to find out the nature of the infiltration. Is it similar to what we've seen before? Is it a virus that we've seen before? Is it a new type of virus? And we're also working with private companies so that they can share information with each other that may help prevent future attacks also. This is an area in which, frankly, government cannot solve this problem alone. It's an area in which we truly need cooperation from the private sector. And this is across our economy, because really it is, as we become much more dependent on living in the cloud, as wonderful as that is, and it really is a great thing, it really does put so much of, not just our data, but our operations and our infrastructure at risk. And so it is an area in which we really need everyone working on this. In addition to government working on it, the private sector working on it, Congress is working on it. The department is working with Congress now, looking at different bills that would hopefully provide protection for companies who need to share data, because, of course, sometimes there are liability concerns. We understand that, and we understand that that sometimes prevents companies from being able to, in their view, really share a lot of the information that would be helpful from a law enforcement perspective. So it's really a multi-pronged approach.
One of the things that John McCain said today is that Russia is even better than China in this sphere. Are we losing an escalating cyber war?
Well, I'm not looking to compliment either of those two actors, actually. But I will say that we're very involved in looking at a number of countries and trying to gauge their capabilities and trying to gauge the level of infiltration that they can and may have had in the U.S.
Do you have the resources? Does the administration, does the Department of Justice have the resources, the skill set, and the financial resources, given the sequester and everything else that's been going on, to come up with solutions in something this challenging?
Well, sequester is a challenge. I will tell you, across the board, sequester is a challenge, and it certainly has been. It hit before I was in this chair. But I was in my old office as a U.S. attorney, and certainly it was very, very difficult managing the financial issues that it left us with. And we're hoping to see a cessation of that at some point. We're very, very hopeful that we can move past that type of thinking that sort of shrinks us and cuts us without regard for what we need to do. Certainly, it's a very resource-intensive area. But not just for us. As I mentioned before, private industry is very much needed in this fight. Legislation is very much needed in this fight. We're actively trying to look for people with the skills and talents for our law enforcement agencies also who can help us with this fight. So it becomes an educational issue. It becomes an issue of keeping our kids competitive, quite frankly, in encouraging them to go into the sciences and technology. So it's a long-term, multifaceted effort.
Guantanamo has been much discussed at this conference. What is the game plan? McCain also said today that he's got the defense authorization bill, that he wants to persuade his colleagues, but he doesn't have a plan yet from the administration for how to close it down effectively, transfer prisoners to prisons here.
Well, certainly closing Guantanamo Bay has been a priority of the administration for a number of years. And I certainly think that people who across the aisle, such as Senator McCain, join him in seeing the value of that, both from a financial perspective and also from a values perspective. And of course, the devil's always in the details. How do we do it? We have been working on transferring people pursuant to very, very strict protocols. I certainly think that in terms of getting plans up to Congress, I know that others in the administration are working on those. So I'll defer to them in terms of the particulars of that, but I will say it's a matter under grave consideration. Certainly the Department of Justice is working with a number of agencies, and as soon as we receive any other information, we'll throw our efforts behind that as well.
Are there still going to be several prisoners who can either not be repatriated or transferred to supermax prisons here?
You know, I think we have to wait and see what the final plan looks like. I think it will be done in conjunction with a number of eyes and a number of interests looking at it. A number of people will want to weigh in from various sides. So I think it's simply too early to say what the final details will be on who will go where.
Jonathan Pollard, also an issue that arose this weekend. Can you tell us...
You've had a busy weekend.
precisely. And we saw the statement from Justice yesterday, yeah. But could you bring us up to date on the mandatory, mandatory sentencing after 30 years? Is that a mandatory release on parole? Where does that now sit?
Actually, it is. It is. Our sentencing, our criminal laws and our sentencing laws have changed a great deal over the past 15, 20 years since I became a prosecutor. And, of course, many of us are working to reform them in other ways also. When Mr. Pollard was sentenced some 30 years ago, I believe he received a life sentence. But at the time, the system still provided for parole. And under the operation of law, after 30 years, it is a mandatory operation of parole, absent a host of things in terms of other violations that may or may not have been committed here. And in accordance with the law, his sentence has been carried out. He is essentially one of the few people who is still a prisoner under the older set of sentencing laws. And that's why I think it may seem surprising to many people now. Our sentencing structure has changed significantly in the late 80s and early 90s to where now a life sentence is, in fact, a life sentence. But under the law under which he was sentenced and the laws of our country under which we abide, he's coming up for release.
And is that a recommendation that you would be making to the Board of Parole?
It's not really a recommendation needed from us. They simply evaluate his behavior in prison. They evaluate all the factors and circumstances, and we look at it to determine if there's anything that we would need to investigate or further review, and provide that information to the parole board, which then makes the final decision.
Can you address the reporting that there is some linkage between his release and foreign policy considerations after the Iran deal to try to assuage Israel?
Well, I can't really address that because I haven't been involved in any of those statements. I would say that it would have been extremely far-thinking of people 30 years ago to sentence Mr. Pollard and set this mandatory release date to coincide with the Iran deal. And if they were able to pull that off, I'd be quite impressed. But this really is an operation of law that would have operated regardless of what was going on in other foreign policy circles.
Hi, Pamela Brown with CNN. If you look over the past few months, there have been a number of ISIS-related arrests. In many of these cases, the person appears to be, as you pointed out earlier, disillusioned, disenfranchised. In some cases, they have a history of mental illness. It seems like ISIS is most appealing to that kind of group of people. So that combined with the fact that people are more quickly going from aspirational to operational, sometimes in a matter of just a few days, what kind of a challenge does that present to the Department of Justice in terms of deciding when to prosecute?
Well, the challenge is frankly, finding these individuals before they become operational. And as you mentioned, because they're not really operating with a structure or with a clear-cut plan that's been blessed by an organization, they are really acting on their own. And so you always try and stay ahead of them, but frankly, sometimes that's not possible. So we always, if we find a situation, many of the cases you've mentioned, involve people who either are trying to carry out acts of violence or they're trying to travel overseas to Syria, for example, to join ISIS or still to join Al-Qaeda or Al-Shabaab, And we look to see what their networks might be. We look to see who else might be involved in their plan to see, is this the only plan that's out there? So there's a number of things that we look to. In terms of how you handle the prosecution of individuals, every defendant is different, quite frankly. And defendants who have a troubled background, a troubled past, do present specific challenges to law enforcement. But we do try and work out a plan that will take into account their mental state. But if someone has the requisite mental state to form the intent to go into either a company or a store or any other place of business and try and kill people in the name of ISIS, then they're going to be dealt with according to law. The real issue that we're facing, quite frankly, that's related to your question, is the increasing number of young people who were drawn into the rhetoric of ISIS, people who are juveniles in the criminal justice system, both state and federal. How do we handle those situations is something that a number of us are giving a lot of thought to. In terms of how do we involve their families? Are there ways that we can intervene, if not before they get down that path? If they've taken certain steps, can they be stopped before they become operational? So there's a lot of challenges with this, and there's a lot of thought and discussion being had about it.
Well, if I may speak for this audience, I am incredibly honored and delighted to have been able to interview you and to be hosting this. It has been a real pleasure. Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks once again this week to the Aspen Institute for giving us permission to use this audio. As always, our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And please spread the word and promote the Lawfare Podcast on your social networks, Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat if you're too embarrassed by your obsession, email, and in any other way you can. We'll appreciate it. Thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.